I always thought Sammy Davis Jr. was the coolest member of the Rat Pack. I don't know, maybe that's just me. I never really did have any use for Frank Sinatra. But you know what? After I got done researching this story, I respect the guy a lot more. This is the story about Portland as the scene of Sammy Davis Jr.'s big break, which I first ran in the newspapers on November 27th, 2011, so it wasn't that long ago. This is fairly fresh. I'm Finn J.D. John, and I write the weekly newspaper column, Offbeat Oregon History, which I sure wish I could rename, but now that there's 175 episodes in the kitty, I guess it's a little too late for that. Anyway, every day I pull up one of these episodes and record it as an archive column to send out on the podcasts. This column, like I said, first published in November 2011, under the headline, Portland was the scene of Sammy Davis Jr.'s big break. All right, here we go. If you hang around the right entertainment venues in Portland, sooner or later someone will tell you that Sammy Davis Jr. got his start here. Well, that's not exactly right, but the City of Roses definitely had a special place in Davis's heart. You could say he caught his big break here, but it would be more accurate to say it was his big break that caught him, rather than the other way around. Portland just happened to be where he was when that happened. Here's a story. Sammy Davis Jr. was a showman born and bred. His parents were both respected vaudevillians. His mother was a chorus singer, and his father was already a storied song and dance man, both of them living in New York when he was born. The gregarious young lad didn't have a chance. He was sucked up into show business at the age of two when his dad took him on stage and sang with him on his lap. They became a trio then, Sammy and his dad and his dad's best friend, Will Maston. They called themselves the Will Maston Trio. Later, as little Sammy got bigger, they started calling themselves the Will Maston Trio featuring Sammy Davis Jr. The kid was that good. But of course, you knew that. When World War II came along, young Sammy was called up as soon as he turned 18. The Army quickly figured out he was more useful on the stage than he was in a trench, and he spent much of his time in the Army performing. The Army was a horrible shock to young Sammy, who for the first 18 years of his life had never really left the world of vaudeville performers. Like a lot of high-performance professions, vaudeville was a world in which ability was king. A young black fellow on the vaudeville circuit would certainly see some racism. Segregated facilities, rude hotel clerks, that kind of thing. But it was nothing like the outside world. And it was nothing like the vitriol and outright hatred that young Sammy faced in the Army. This was somewhat ironic. It was the Army that taught a whole generation of white Americans to drop their racist views, which they found hard to square with what they learned of the quality and character of black soldiers who fought beside them and occasionally saved their lives. For young Sammy, perhaps because the people he encountered weren't in combat, the experience was quite different. It was particularly shocking for Sammy because from infancy, Sammy Sr. and Uncle Will Maston had shielded him from what relatively little racism there was in vaudeville. That man's just jealous because we're in show business and he's going to be pushing beans the rest of his damn life, Sammy Sr. told his young son on one occasion after a drugstore lunch counter clerk dropped an N-bomb on the three entertainers and ordered them to sit at the, quote, colored end of the counter. But the Army was different. There was no mistaking getting one's face spat on, wristwatch smashed, and nose broken, or having racial slurs applied to one's forehead in oil-based paint. That wasn't mere jealousy. It was a harsh way to lose one's innocence, and it left an unmistakable bitterness that took a long time to fade. Sammy left the Army more determined than ever to use his talents to change the world in whatever way he could. But he was profoundly demoralized. You can't mistake the bleakness in his prose when he writes in his memoirs about that time in his life. Where once he'd been a proud showbiz man, feeling like his life was glamorous and going places, now he felt the rut he was in. And it was definitely a rut by now. The fortunes of the Will Maston Trio were fading like the vaudeville era they were part of, fading to a starvation diet of shows in different towns, the occasional grueling strings of one-night stands, to the dreaded day when they'd have to get up and start pushing beans themselves. But some of Sammy's old friends had made it big, really big. One of those people was Frank Sinatra. The Will Maston Trio had performed with him in 1941. Now, in the post-war years, Sammy managed to reconnect with the chairman of the board, whose star was rising like a rocket. It was good to have successful friends. But that didn't pay the bills, though. Sammy's group played on. Chicago. Los Angeles. Boston. Portland. The Will Maston Trio was in Portland for 2 years, playing regularly in the Clover Room nightclub, among other local hotspots. Sammy and his team were one of Stumptown's hottest draws, but still, it wasn't exactly a prestige gig. Although it had a sizzling jazz scene at the time, Portland was not an A-list town, and it was on the way to almost nowhere. Portland has to have been one of the lowest points for the trio. It's certainly among the least important cities they performed in. But Sammy was a showman. He loved to be loved, and there's no question but that Portland loved him. Plus, there may have been racism in Portland. Well, let's just put it out right. There was racism in Portland, but at least it wasn't a back-of-the-bus-boy kind of town. He doesn't talk about this in his memoirs, but it's at least possible Sammy was planning on sticking around a while, settling down, settling for being a big fish in a small pond. But then in 1947, a telegram arrived from Frank Sinatra's agent, Harry Rogers. Changed everything. Here it is, I'm quoting it. "Open Capitol Theater, New York, next month," it read. "Frank Sinatra show, 3 weeks, $12.50 per, details follow." "We passed that telegram back and forth like three drunks working out of the same bottle," Sammy wrote in his memoirs. Significantly, Sammy stuck around Portland for several years after his big break, basking in the glow of its audiences and hanging out with its showbiz people as his career started lifting off. Sticking around well after his roster of options had expanded to include much more prestigious cities. After 1947, the Will Maston Trio was on its way, with a little help from an old friend. Life for the three of them would never be the same. And as for friends of Frank Sinatra's Rat Pack, it would be remembered as the dawn of a golden age. Well, that's it for today. You've been listening to an Offbeat Oregon History Archive column. If you'd like to hear more of these, there's hundreds of them on the website at offbeatoregon.com. By the way, if you stumbled across this column on iTunes and you enjoyed it, if you wouldn't mind taking just a minute to write a review on iTunes expressing yourself as having enjoyed it, that would be awesome. This column's covered under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license. For details, you can go to offbeatoregon.com/cc. And if you're ever up in Corvallis, drop me a note. I'm always up for a cup of something with fellow history geeks, especially if there's good coffee involved. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, @offbeatoregon. And finally, I just wanted to let you know, if you haven't noticed yet, my book just came out, Wicked Portland, The Wild and Lusty Underworld of a Frontier Seaport Town. And you know, if you like this podcast, you're going to like the book too, so I would totally invite you to check it out. It's at wicked-portland.com. That's it for today, so have a great day.